tape was made at the Philosophical Research Society on June 19, 1979. The speaker is Mr. Manly P. Hall, and the subject is In Bondage to Freedom.
When our founding fathers brought forth this nation, they were working very definitely to achieve the advancement of the policy of humanism that was developing in Europe. It centered around the concept of the rights of the human being, that the individual had inalienable rights before God and nature, and that these rights must be recognized on the level of political leadership. As it developed gradually down through the first 50 years of our national existence, it began to appear that freedom was gradually developing into the right to be wrong. In other words, freedom largely became a symbol of doing as we please, without regard for consequences or for the rights of others. Freedom was the inalienable right of the individual to do that which he desired to do. And the problem of a national existence was to develop some form of political structure which would enable each individual to be a rugged individualist. Now, this was difficult. In fact, it has never been solved. And we observe around us today the results of numerous efforts on the parts of nations, especially smaller nations, to escape from bondage to major powers, the gradual disintegration of colonial empires. And in almost every instance, the newly liberated community turned upon itself and abused its own privileges. When we come into the life of the individual, we have the same general situation. There is scarcely anything that anyone can do today that someone else will not object to. To be different is to be wrong. And to differ from a personal opinion of someone else is to be open to all types of ridicule and persecution. The idea has gradually developed that we were born into this world to do exactly as we please, and that anyone who interfered with this is a tyrant. Nature and experience both demonstrate that this concept is wrong. But unless the individual is able to discipline himself, he must be disciplined by someone else, or the structure of his communities will fall apart. So today, where there is very little incentive for self-discipline in the popular ways of doing things, it is necessary for us to take over this situation as persons and recognize that we must enforce certain rules in our own conduct. We must think through the problems of our own existence. We must plan. We must organize resources. We must live within capacities and abilities, or we will be in trouble forever. To meet this challenge, we have to begin with perhaps the most common unit, and that is the family. We know that today children are ever less willing to follow parental guidance. They consider their forebears to be obsolete. They consider their own privileges and rights as inalienable, and more resent any infringement upon their privileges. And if these privileges mean the right to do wrong, they insist that this is their proper destiny. One of the main difficulties here, of course, is that today we are trying to discipline young people too late. By the time the child is 10 or 12 years old, the chances of disciplining it thoroughly are very remote. And if we wait until the child does something that is so dangerous or improper that we must take notice of it, it is too late to correct the situation. So we follow the only course that nature has left open to us, realizing that we cannot change these people once their characters are formed. We must return the job to the universal law itself. We must take these people whom we can no longer control and turn them back to heaven to take care of. The laws of nature and the laws of living will ultimately force these radicals back into some type of social pattern. But we may never live to see it. And before this happens, there may be desperate dangers to the social structure. Now, we all like to do what we please. And more, we live by this concept. It is aided and abetted by a series of other circumstances. One of the most important being the insecurities of the present generation. We live at a time when to many people the only answer to the successful life is to have as much as you can get right now. Enjoy it all you can right now. And have very little hope or expectancy for the future. This also leads gradually to a demoralization of character. The individual, lacking social securities and lacking security within himself, is an easy victim to a whole group of psychological and psychotic ailments. When he becomes so disturbed and so uncomfortable that he can no longer live with himself, it does not always occur to him to change himself. Rather, he goes on psychotic drugs of one kind or another to reduce his pressures by putting them to sleep rather than by solving them. This situation does add to the general insecurity. Another factor that is very important in our way of life is what we commonly call the concept of wealth. In our way of life here at the present time, wealth takes the place of the autocratic privileges of the past. In ancient times, it was believed that rulers governed by the divine right of kings. Today, we assume that rulers govern by the divine right of dollars. Whoever has enough of them can do as he pleases. Little by little, we have turned all our faith in the direction of accumulation. We have taken it for granted that we are here to get as much as we can, give as little as possible, work when we have to, but avoid it if possible. This philosophy is not necessarily a very good one. There's a story told of a man in his 80s who was interviewed as to the circumstances that had made it possible for him to have such a long life. The man said, "Well, I had a business, and after a certain length of time, I made $10 million and sold the business. The man I sold it to made $300 million, and he's dead. He left it to another man who doubled it, and he's dead. Therefore, the prime note for this person was, if your paper wishes to have something to say about the party they were interviewing, he said, just say that I can still walk every day in Central Park." Now today, in building and piling up these enormous fortunes, the individual destroys himself. Yet it never occurs to him to discipline this type of pressure. It never occurs to him to realize that beyond this world, he can take nothing of this pressure belonging that he has accumulated. If it is true that after death there is nothing, then there is really very little good in having too much here now, because it is all going to be forgotten. And the rich and the poor will fall asleep in the same oblivion. If there is something beyond here, it is then as obvious that whatever that is not wealth. We cannot take it with us. No matter what philosophy we follow, it ends, as far as possessions are concerned, when we depart here from this place. Under such conditions, why this mad traffic for wealth? Why this tremendous willingness to sacrifice everything, drench the world in blood, try to satisfy the ambitions of individuals of uncertain integrity, when it all ends in darkness? The whole philosophy is wrong. And therefore, in an effort to maintain a false goal, we have frustrated the natural right of the individual to be happy. In order to be happy, it is necessary to be disciplined. Socrates pointed out very clearly that the great rule of life is in nothing too much. In all things, only enough. To possess too much is to be a slave to possession. To lack the necessity is to be a slave to privation. To have enough is to free the life from all the stress and strain of unreasonable attitudes and actions, and liberate the mind for the contemplations of values above the level of wealth. Now, a great many modern thinkers are trying to solve this problem of wealth. They believe that if we could solve that, we would be in a position to build a utopian culture. Unfortunately, that does not necessarily follow. Wealth is a symbol of a basic attitude. And if currency or investments, stocks, and bonds were all suddenly removed, we would then gradually and inevitably develop a new theory of wealth. Because to us, wealth is power. And to possess that which gives privilege is the most important thing in life. There seems to be this trait in human nature. The willingness of the individual to die for the things that he wants in order to live well. This type of frustration is always difficult. to begin a political society that can survive, we have to begin to think in a different way. We have to decide in ourselves what constitutes a good life. What are the privileges that freedom bestows? One of the most important privileges is the privilege of being right. In the past, there were all kinds of laws and rules that made it difficult for us to be right. Our ancestors came to this country to escape tyrannies that prevented them from having normal and reasonable self-expressions. They wanted to escape tyranny and slavery and serfdom. They wanted the right to be a person. They wanted the right to live as individuals. And as soon as that right was at least in part given to them, they began to encroach upon each other's privileges, assuming that the right to do as we please is part of freedom. It is not. It is that factor which almost inevitably will lead freedom back to slavery. To develop our own thinking now, we are living in very confused and hazardous times. And it is marked notably that a frenzy has developed, a frenzy which is leading to inflation, a frenzy which is causing every individual to be the victim of other individuals. Every possible means of exploiting man is being pressed forward by man himself. It has become a battlefield of pressures under which the average person breaks down psychologically and physically. All of it shows that what we have interpreted as freedom is license to exploit. Now, this is not easy to correct. But lots of things can be done if the individual will start to exercise the true privileges of freedom. If he is free to live according to his own convictions, he has the right to grow, the right to be more, the right to be better. Now, in the first 100-150 years of our national life, this right to be better was still remembered fairly well. But now the right to be better is fading away. And one of the reasons it's fading away is that we are losing track of what constitutes better. We are not sure anymore how to grow or in what direction growth should lead. We are not convinced any longer that growth is the unfoldment of the potential of the individual. One of the things that is inhibiting this factor, which our ancestors were more aware of, has been the gradual decline of the religious leadership of older days. Religion was one of the most powerful factors in directing human effort. And when religion was strong, powerful, and well diffused throughout society, the individual enjoyed the strength of his religious environment. He was surrounded by people who kept the rules, who had the ideals and dreams that were essentially right. And he therefore had a security or strength of number. It was more difficult for him to be dishonest in those days than it is now. It was more difficult for him to be immoral, because morality was a clearly defined standard. And to leave that standard or to break it was to disgrace self and to lose caste. In other words, individuals with religious allegiances formed the peer group, and all others wished to be part of this peer group. Today, the leadership of a group of solid, intelligent, dedicated persons is failing. They simply are not the kind that we find when we turn for example in leadership. We find that every effort is being made continuously to lower the threshold of human integrities. We realize that there is a constant effort to destroy, tear down, disillusion us about those values which are essentially correct. Instead of being applauded for our honesty, we are apt to be ridiculed for it. Instead of being defended for our proprieties, we are accused simply of being too weak to be bad. This type of attitude, of course, is tied very closely to our educational theory. Education, which should help us to administer freedom, is now one of the most powerful instruments in establishing and maintaining bondage. Education is teaching us to be slaves, teaching us to follow the prescribed policies of our time. And more educational institutions are compromising ethics in order to perpetuate the present prevailing practices. We have a very definite situation here that needs a considerable amount of remedy. There is some kind of a pattern of irresponsibility that is being furthered and advanced by what we term educational structure. Also, education is largely the result of observed phenomena. Education has something to do with the books we read. It has to do with the dramas we see, the music we listen to, the pictures we observe in libraries and museums. The environment is very largely a force in determining our taste. We observe that on all these levels, values are failing. More and more, everything is used to preserve the decadence that is becoming more and more prevalent. One thing, for example, I signed a statement a couple of days ago to try to help to preserve and protect the religion and philosophy department in the Los Angeles Public Library. There's a move on foot, at least in some part of the situation. I'm not fully informed, but I signed the petition anyway, to the effect that religion and philosophy were to become subdivisions within the social sciences. In other words, the major sections in the major sections of the library, out. Now, on what grounds is this done? I would like to suggest that if the library is out of funds, and Proposition 13 is working a hardship on our public library system, that one of the most interesting and possibly profitable things the library could do is to eliminate the fiction department. Actually, the fiction department is at variance with the basic principles of libraries. We could not look back on the Serapeum or the Brachium in Alexandria and get very much excited over its fiction departments. It didn't have any. The great libraries of Europe were all founded before there was fiction. The great collections of books were collected for one purpose only, the preservation of knowledge. And today, the publishers deluging us with books that contribute to nothing, that merely represent emotional reading, that are oriented to a moral standard far too low, are dealing with scandal, gossip, and all kinds of social prejudices and conceits, and the community is paying to have these precious volumes encased in the library. If you want fiction, it is available in paperback. Nearly anyone can afford it who wants it. But it is not essential to the advancement of knowledge. We might as well say that the public library should issue free tickets for baseball games, bowling alleys, billiard parlors. If it is here merely to serve the amusement of the public, then it is not serving the public as it should. Fiction is entertainment. Libraries are not intended to give free entertainment. They are intended to communicate useful ideas. They are essential to specialists in various fields. But if by some chance that the specialists in modern fiction are somewhat deprived, I think they will recover. We could take almost any public library in the United States and trim it down. And if we preserved the principle behind libraries, we'd still have room on the shelves for a lot of more books, because we'd get rid of trash reading, which, as far as our mental education, stimulation, and nutrition are concerned, these fields are just about as valuable as heavy carbohydrates and junk foods. We are getting much mental junk food. And the people who love it have not the discrimination to know that it is no good for them. So they continue to read this type of thing. And the institutions, instead of leading the public mind, cater to it. Instead of the library helping the individual to establish a standard of proper thinking, the library buys millions of books simply to cater to no standard, or to a standard that should never be tolerated, let alone catered to. So here's where the freedom comes in. If the fiction department was taken out, the library would no doubt be picketed. Every group would be there to defend its own particular specialty. And whether that specialty is any good or not, nobody cares. It is the right of the individual to read the worst literature on earth if he wants to, or to go to see any motion picture or play that he wants to see, regardless of how bad it is in terms of public good. So this is where we are in bondage to a concept of freedom that is basically wrong. In order to correct this situation, we have to realize that we head into a tremendous economic structure, a structure that is getting richer every moment by catering to the bad taste of people. As long as the individual prefers to buy that which is not good, he will not get anything better. The only way that this problem can be really solved is by the individual or the collective group, which we call a citizenry, interprets freedom as the right to stand up for principles. This is very important. If we use our freedom to demand that which is best for all concerned, or use our freedom to discriminate and to protect our own children and their children from compromise and corruption, if we use our freedoms correctly, we can have what we need. Because even the hopelessly involved, financially minded person will give the public what it wants. But the problem of leadership is to prepare the public to want what it needs. This situation is coming home to all of us more and more. It's coming home to us in this gasoline emergency. It is coming to us in the problems of energy. It is coming to us in the problem of treaties in Vienna. It is coming to us in revolutions all over the earth. The individual must either side with that which is secure, right, and proper, and stand ready to protect it, or we will all slowly drift together from one emergency to another. We can't go along without some facts and values. If we go back to the natural world in which we live, and which, of course, is the basic textbook for most thoughtful persons, we observe that nature does bestow a great deal of freedom. Nature more or less creates an adequate environment, but it is a controlled environment. It adjusts creatures to this environment, both in terms of their structures and in terms of their numbers. Nature has an interrelating system by means of which gradually two situations arise. Survival depends upon, first, strength. And as the strength pattern is gradually overgrown or outgrown, then the second factor of survival comes in, and that is judgment, wisdom. All creatures must survive because they are strong enough to survive, or they are wise enough to survive. Those which break this rule, or these rules, suffer as a consequence. In nature, that which is not strong enough physically to meet the challenge of environment perishes. And in this way, nature preserves almost indefinitely the vitality strain of practically every living creature. Only the best survives. Only the best reproduce or perpetuate. And by this means, nature, by pressing upon the environment, is able to regulate or protect the survival of the species itself. The second thing that nature tells us is that every form of life, in order to survive, has to learn. Now, it's interesting that the most basic learning which we find in nature is silent learning. Learning is not read out of books by birds and bugs. Learning is almost all through example. I remember old Chief Seaton, in his nature stories, told so many tales of how nature teaches. How the little one is forever observing the way with which its adults, parents, meet the facts of life. The parents regulate, and when they have brought the young to maturity, they then demand that young person to stand on its own feet. The bird casts the little one out of the nest. It will not allow spoilage. Nature is forever telling the young creature, follow the example of the parent. Obey instinctively and inevitably. When the parent crouches down, crouch down. When the parent rushes into a thicket, rush in with it. Because all you have to do is decide you're going to disobey, and in a few minutes, you'll be dead. Now, this is a harsh way of learning, but it is very adequate. And for millions of years, nature maintained the balance of species until the human being, who was like Bottom in the Midsummer Night's Dream, slow of learning, upset the entire situation. It is the human being that very largely demoralized every other kingdom of nature on this planet. But there's always a chance to do something about it if we want to. And conservationists are trying. But then conservationists do not always have nature's point of view. Nature isn't patting animals, birds, flowers, or fishes. It is teaching them. Teaching them the rules by which they must live. And as they live close to these rules, obeying the laws of their kind, they accomplish the greatest freedom that is possible in this world. Freedom is therefore the result or the reward of not making basic mistakes. It is to follow the laws of the kind, to follow the rules of the seasons, and to follow the internal instincts with which all creatures have been endowed. Man is violating these rules. He feels that freedom is to be above his own instincts, to be able to go against his own conscience with impunity. The mysterious little voice that teaches the bird and the little animal comes to man apparently in the form of conscience, a realization that the individual is breaking the rule. And whenever he feels that way, he should pause and give it a consideration. And he shouldn't allow his mental attitudes to rationalize him into believing that he can break conscience with impunity. The recent visit of Pope John Paul, to Poland has been a very interesting experience. It shows that naturally the human being is religious. There may be different types of religion, different degrees, levels, ways of being religious. There are different sects and different rites and different ceremonies and different names. But the individual's natural instinct to venerate the universal pattern to which he belongs, to recognize the presence of a sovereign power at the source of life, this instinct has not been greatly altered by all the materialistic political theories that have ever been advanced. These theories break down because the human being cannot live with them. They result in a starvation of integrities. They destroy the inner balance of life. Therefore, in an effort to be right, the individual continues to believe the principles that are necessary to his well-being. And if he cannot believe them publicly, he protects them privately in the inner part of his own soul. He is not going to be completely deprived of them. We have fought for a long time for freedom of religion, considering it to be one of the basic freedoms of mankind. In our present sophisticated generation, we are fighting for freedom from religion. And this is a very serious error. But freedom from religion means the gradual decay and decline of every integrity that is necessary to us. Every child coming into this world must have some type of religious education. The easiest, simplest, and most natural is that it should receive it at home, like the little animal does, and should learn to be religious by observing the practices of its mature associates. Religion begins by parental indoctrination of the young and is a heavy responsibility upon the parent. because many parents are religious, but are not necessarily on a level of religion that can safely be communicated. It is very important that when a parent communicates religion, that he leaves his biases, his prejudices, and his intolerances out of it. And he can't do this in most cases. Religion to most individuals today means to follow the exact beliefs of those who have gone before. It does not mean a personal, voluntary commitment to a power beyond ourselves. It is absorbed into memberships and creeds and sects and isms of one kind or another. Our search for freedom also has to gain us a freedom from the consequences of freedom. One of these is debt. Today, we are very heavily in debt. Nations are in debt. Governments are in debt. Organizations are in debt. As one man said not long ago, we are a generation of people living on the interest from our own debts. We continue to borrow and borrow and on the debt. We are not living within a practical pattern of economy. We are being, however, tempted. We are being incited into extravagance which we should have the strength to resist. But it is very difficult to resist the desire to have more. The discipline here is the ability to curb the freedom to spend, to know what is right and to know what is not right. I've always been interested in the fact that in the old days, back 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, the great state institutions of religion, the mysteries, were the most powerful organizations of their time. They were the church and the state. They were the sciences and the arts. They were the universities and the shrines. They were the instructors of the living and created the memorials of the dead. All knowledge, all learning was vested in these institutions. Those who entered these institutions became the leading citizens of their time. And most of the honored names that we remember out of the classical periods were initiates of these state systems, bound by the most solemn obligations. There is no doubt in the world that many of the metaphysical disciplines that we have today were known to these people. And among these disciplines, self-discipline and the cultivation of internal extra-faculty perceptions were part of the curriculum. Now, in that situation, society honored the best, although, of course, no generation was ever able to live up to its principles completely. But there was a greater approximation. And there was a strong leadership towards spiritual things, towards education. There was respect for the arts and sciences, and a heavy penalty for desecrating them. If a musician composed an enharmonic or discordant piece of music, he was subject to punishment. He might be exiled from the city. He might lose his citizenship. If his music could, by any excuse or conception, contribute to the detriment of society. The same was true of architecture, of painting. Physicians made no charges. Lawyers made no charges. These things were all part of a great system of ethics. Now we can say to ourselves, what a pity it is that such a system faded away. destroyed by the rising ambitions of individuals who corrupted, destroyed, and desecrated the shrines of ancient learning. But apparently this was part of the divine plan of things. And if we think a moment, I think we can understand why it was part of the divine plan. It was because, like a child growing up, there had to come a time when we stood on our own feet. The home might be likened to one of these mystery temples. Here the small child learns to adjust itself to the physical world in which it lives. The home was responsible for the education of the child, for the disciplining of it. The home protected its physical needs and, to a large measure, its psychological needs. But after the child has grown up, if the family continues to dominate it, then we are apt to have corruption and tyranny. We are apt to have relatives who step in and...